Good morning and welcome to Shattering Myths, the program devoted to those of you who are open to the realization or it who have come to understand that all of the world's religious, political, military, media, and economic institutions are corrupt, that they're all counterproductive, that promising to be dependable, promising to be compassionate, promising to be enlightened and to being moral, they are in all cases counterproductive. We typically in this program begin at the first hour in the news, and we're just going to touch that this morning before we move back to what should have been the biggest news story in the history of mankind, which is Yosha's Sermon on the Mount, where in his introductory statements he absolutely destroyed the religion that would later claim to be based upon his testimony. But before we do that, and because in the second hour today we're going to have a discussion with IQ Al-Rasuli, the foremost expert on Islam, it is hard to regain one's balance. And that is the case with me this morning. After witnessing the pictures of this tidal wave of Muslims migrating into Europe, I'm sure you've seen them, Kirk. They're terribly disturbing.
They're getting even more and more violent, and it's pretty bad stuff.
Yeah, it's a combination of many things. One is that, yes, they are getting more and more violent. And yes, they are throwing things and completely destroying a people's way of life in many of the places that they have come through and that are staying in. But it is obvious in these pictures, based upon their expressions, based upon the dress of the women, that they're bringing the very plague that caused this migration with them. And there really is no difference here, folks, in letting these Muslims into Europe than bringing those infected with Ebola.
That would be my analogy.
Yeah, into your country. The only difference is Ebola is now about 40% lethal. Islam is 100% lethal.
There's another difference.
Yeah.
They willingly admit that Ebola is dangerous.
Yeah. They'll people acknowledge it's dangerous. Yeah, people acknowledge it's dangerous. That's correct. And with Islam, no one is even willing to acknowledge that it is dangerous, that it is the cause of the wars that have created the living hell for those suffering throughout Syria, Iraq, Afghanistan, and Libya. I mean, keep in mind, those fleeing are fleeing Islamic countries. They're Muslims fleeing from Muslims killing Muslims, Muslims raping Muslims, Muslims enslaving Muslims. And yet they're not renouncing the disease, the religion, the political apparatus that brought this hell upon them, them and their families.
So one mafia family gets away from the other mafia family, they're still mafia.
Yeah. You know, there's another difference with Ebola. You can actually cure Ebola.
Yeah.
You know, 60% of those who get Ebola are cured of it. You can't cure somebody of religion. Not when they have it to the degree these people have it. Today, there is news that a supporter at a Donald Trump rally made the comment that Obama is a Muslim man and the problem with America is Muslims.
Mm-hmm. I read that.
And Trump is being trounced for not correcting it. Trump didn't make the comment. I don't even think Trump made a comment regarding the person's comment.
Just said let him talk, I believe.
You know, the fact is that whether or not Obama is a Muslim, a Christian, or a socialist secular humanist, I would tell you that by the Quran's definition of a Muslim, by the Islamic definition of a Muslim, he's a Muslim. His father was a Muslim. He was schooled in madrasas.
Yeah.
He's a Muslim by all Islamic definitions, by the Quran's definition. There is no, while he claims that he's a Christian, and I think he only claims he's a Christian for the express purpose of being electable.
Politics, yeah.
Yeah, politics. The fact of the matter is that that the church that he went to, Reverend Wright, is more anti-Semitic or equally anti-Semitic than the religion of Islam. And so it was the difference between Reverend Wright's corruption of Christianity and Louis Farrakhan's creation of his own version of Islam.
Mm-hmm.
The distinction between them is almost nothing.
Yeah, the hate still spews out.
Right. And when you hear Obama speak, everything that he says that indicates that he's a socialist secular humanist, leaning on communist. And so there would be no reason to correct someone who said he's a Muslim man. That doesn't mean that he's a Muslim, but he's a man that certainly supports Islam, condones Islam, lifts up Islam, lies on behalf of Islam.
And you can't deny that. I mean, all his actions.
Right. So, and then when you look at 100% of the terrorist acts perpetrated against America and all of America's current wars, they're all against Muslims.
Well,
they're perpetrated by Muslims. So how can you deny the fact that the problem is Muslims?
No, I can't even understand why nobody knows that there was guys from Arabian Egypt that supposedly flew the planes into the thing. So, come on.
Oh, they on 9/11, it actually was not Egypt. It wasn't. I don't think it was a single Egypt.
No, but four of them for Egypt, and the rest of them on
Saudi Arabia.
Yeah,
19 were Saudi Arabia.
So we attack Iraq. I mean, come on.
Yeah, yeah. There were no Iraqis involved in 9/11.
No.
There were no 9/11 planners, perpetrators, funders. No one associated with 9/11 was in Iraq, and only was there great separation and a very distant relationship between those in Afghanistan and 9/11. The Taliban had nothing to do with the 9/11, and al-Qaeda had very little to do with it. I mean, the plan for al-Qaeda was created by Ramzi Youssef. He had already been convicted of the first World Trade Center bombing. He created the plan. It's indisputable that he created the exact plan that was perpetrated. And the majority of those who led that plan in America were indoctrinated and funded from the Al-Qaeda Mosque in Hamburg, Germany, and they were Saudi Arabians for the most part. So there was no justification in where we attacked.
Well, thank God that Jeb's brother saved us from the Iraqis.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Jeb's brother, he kept America safe. Yeah, they did a beautiful job on 9/11 keeping us safe. We knew the 9/11 plot 5 years before it occurred, and we did nothing to protect America from it. And then once it occurred, the president obliterated censoring all connection to Islam and to Saudi Arabia by editing the Pentagon's and the Independent report on 9/11. And then he lied to invade Iraq and Afghanistan and got 10,000 Americans killed directly and 250,000 that committed suicide thereafter. Now, if that's keeping you safe, bankrupting the country in the process and unleashing a war that is sending a flood of Muslim migrants throughout the world to undermine those countries, if that's keeping the country safe, you've got a hole in your head. And just think of the crowd at the Republican debate out there at the Reagan Library applauded. Too stupid to know the difference. We have Glenn on the line. Good morning, Glenn. Haven't heard from you in a week or so.
I have been so busy, it's unreal. It's a very busy time.
Good.
But Charles Martel must be spinning in his grave. You know, because he's the one who, one of the, you know, people who stopped the Muslims from invading Europe. That was in 1732, but their efforts continued for quite a long time after that.
Yeah, that was in the Balkans, right?
Actually, I'd have to read up on it more. I just have the dates up in my head.
They had infiltrated from the islands off of Italy and were threatening Rome. They had invaded and were occupying much of the Balkans, and they were moving towards France, as I understand it, and I haven't read this in a while, when they were finally stopped. And it was a combination, really, of battles, but in the 18th century, or is it 1700s or 1800s? But
it'd be 17.
Yeah, I don't have the dates handy, but it
was continuous. You know?
Yeah, and you know this idea that the Crusades were what started this, you know, just not true at all. They right after Muhammad's death, within the 100 years of his death, the first war after his death was the War of Compulsion, which forced all Arabians to capitulate, either lose your head or acquiesce to Islam, surrender to Islam. It's called the War of Compulsion. And then they fought a war against the Persians, who had been beaten to a pulp by the Romans, and they beat the Persians, forcing them to convert from Zoroastrianism to Islam. And then they pushed west, and they took Israel from the Byzantine Empire, Syria from the Byzantine Empire. They conquered Egypt and were barbarians throughout North Africa. Absolute savages. And all of that in the first 100 years of the Islamic era is called the Golden Era of Islam. It should be called the Blood Red Era of Islam, the barbarian era of Islam. And you know, then they began battles against Byzantinia outside of Israel and Syria, and it was a long war, and ultimately it wasn't until the Mongols and the Turks became one under the Ottoman Empire, and you had the viciousness and the tactics of the Mongols controlling the population of what was then Turkey, becoming the Ottoman Empire, that they waged war against Europe for hundreds of years. Briefly, the review of Islam in Europe is one that is not talked about very often, but the Muslims began to invade Europe within 100 years of Muhammad's death. 711 was the invasion of Spain. That was a successful invasion. And they continued to attack Europe, really, from all sides, all the way from 711 and through the 18th century. So this is this focus on the Crusaders being bad for trying to retake that which was taken from them is absurd, and particularly in light of the fact that the Islamic onslaught of the Middle East and Africa and Europe continued unabated for many, many centuries.
You know what, Yawa, saw a fascinating, YouTube video that's showing a map in the history, and if you just search on YouTube, you know, if you just search, actually, if you search for Muslim invasions of Europe, you'll get a YouTube link, and it's just fascinating. It's this map with little red dots, and the narrator just shows, you just see the over time, you know, the various Muslim incursions into Eastern and Western Europe. But it seems like now they found the fastest way to invade Europe is just send them in with open hands, begging food and with no weapons, and just take over the culture. You know,
yes.
tell the Germans not to have Oktoberfest. Tell European women how to dress. You know, the Saudis want to put mosques all over Germany. Basically, this is an invasion, but which does not as yet involve weapons that much.
You know, if you Google Muslim invasion of Europe, for most of the initial articles come up as what is currently occurring.
Right. Yes,
it is
yes,
the
yes.
most. It's the most successful invasion of a religion into the into a realm that was very sparsely populated with its culture previously. There really is no precedent for this. This is an extraordinary event that is going to fundamentally change Europe.
Right.
It's going to bring in many things. One is anarchy, because everywhere Muslims go, there's anarchy. Number two, it's more dependence, because Muslims as a whole are less prone to work. It's been part of Islam from the beginning. It's a culture that has never bred a industrious economy. Muhammad's and his merry gang never engaged in work. There's not one of them that you can study the Hadith or Quran statements about that was engaged working. They became robbers. It was a criminal enterprise.
Pirates have an aversion to W-4 forms.
Yeah, I guess so. But that's what they were. They were land pirates.
Yeah, and education too, for trade and such too. The effects of this are really crazy. You know, yeah, I really shouldn't stay today, but I'd like to make a momentary announcement for something completely different, alluding to a domestic issue, and then let you get back to what you're doing, if I may. I have the solution to the Bo Bergdahl problem. You know,
oh, okay. Yeah.
Elder
is
effectively captured and drinks, you know, captured by Muslims and drinks tea with them and plays soccer and what have you. He's charged with bad behavior before the enemy. And so I have the perfect answer. He should be treated with honor and made an United States senator from the state of Arizona.
Sure. Right.
That's what we should do with those who, you know, sell out to the enemy.
He should live in his house with him.
John McClown could be his mentor, and he could, reside with him, and the two of them could be the senators for Arizona.
There you go. You know, Bergdahl is such a blight on the American military, because he recognized. As have hundreds of thousands of those who were sent over to Afghanistan and Iraq, that what we were asking men to do was morally bankrupt, that it was counterproductive, that we were squandering lives and squandering our resources, making a bad situation worse, and they all know it. And hundreds of thousands have come back and taken their lives, suicide. That many, many hundreds of thousands are drugged and suffering from post-traumatic shock syndrome. All based on the...
is a psychological success story.
Yeah, he is. By comparison to what's happened to most of those who endured this, he's a success story. He's an embarrassment to them as such. Welcome back to Chattering Myth. The Charles Martel, by the way, battle... which was the decisive blow early on with the Ottoman Empire's, the Islamic, actually before the Ottoman Empire, but the Islamic invasion of Europe after they had successfully invaded the Iberian Peninsula, Spain. It was in the 8th century. But you can read of ongoing battles between the Ottoman Empire and Christian Europe, fought in Christian Europe throughout the 13th, 12th, 13th, 14th, 15th century, even battles as late as the 16th century. So it went on for centuries. An ongoing battle, particularly in the Balkans, which was the area that was part of the Byzantine Empire, part of the old Roman Empire, part of the Eastern Roman Empire, the Byzantine Empire, and became the primary battleground for Europe.
Let me ask you a quick question. I have old books, you know, from hundreds of years old, stuff that I've read, and when they described all the Muslim invasions through Europe, through the Ottoman Empire, through Constantinople. They don't pull any punches. They say that it was just slaughter, and you know, they grew their religion out of with the sword. So I mean, they don't sugarcoat it like a modern history book might.
Mm-hmm.
But they also don't refer to them as Muslims. They refer to them as Mohammedans.
Yeah, that's funny. Yeah. Uh-huh.
And I always thought that that was much more appropriate because they're followers of Muhammad.
Right.
And just like when we are talking about probably next, Christianity doesn't follow Christ. You know?
Right. Right.
They, you know what I'm talking about.
Yeah. Right. You're a Christian,
if you're going to identify with this figure, then you should be following that figure. And at least the Muslims, they are following Muhammad, and they claim to be. So is it because you could associate them so quickly with Muhammad as opposed to some kind of religion that people don't know about? But if he said, I follow Muhammad, then all you got to say is, well, let's look at Muhammad and see what he was all about. And then all of a sudden you couldn't sell it unless you were perverted.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, it's interesting that all
wasn't that clear, sorry, but you know,
all Islam means is to submit, to surrender.
Yeah.
And Muslim means one who submits, one who surrenders. They are surrendering. You know, if you ask a Muslim, they'll say, well, it means submission to God. No, it doesn't. The word just means submission. And when you actually read the Quran, everywhere the Quran says that one has to obey Allah, it also says Allah and His messenger.
And His prophet,
Never prophet.
Oh, never prophet.
No, never prophet. Never. In fact, Muhammad, not only is Muhammad never called a prophet in the Quran, not only does Muhammad never issue a single prophecy to prove his credentials in the Quran on two occasions specifically says that Muhammad was not a prophet. You know, so all of these Muslim groups that want to talk about the prophet Muhammad, no. He is expressly excluded from the club of prophets by the Quran, by Allah. But anyway, throughout the Quran, it's always obey Allah and His messenger. Always.
Mm-hmm.
And so since no one ever met Allah, since there was no proof that Allah even exists, since Allah is a perfect copy, perfect exemplar of Muhammad, they are Mohammedans.
Yeah. Well, it would be easier to talk about them if you identified them as that, I think, than...
Yeah. But, you know, that's their favorite name. How many of these jihadists have the first name Muhammad?
Muhammad Ali.
Yeah, yeah. That was a boy that was just duped. It's a shame.
Yeah.
Lou Alcindor becoming Kareem Abdul-Jabbar and becoming a Muslim. They just just becoming absolute fools. But, you know, that's common. You know, people are extraordinarily easy to fool. I think there was a period of time that Mike Tyson was touted as a Muslim, and didn't Cat Stevens acquiesce to Islam? I mean,
that was what I read. Yeah.
Yeah, you know, who knows what goes through these people's tortured souls, or who was able to indoctrinate them? But it happens every day. It happens on behalf of all manner of creepy cults. So we should not be surprised. In the time we have left in the first hour, I want to return to the Sermon on the Mount because it is so startling to me. And I guess I really wasn't confronted with this until about 7 or 8 years ago. That Christianity, as you said, claims to be followers of Christ and claims that he is the founder of their religion.
Uh-huh.
And yet in his first public address, his longest recorded speech, his foundational speech, the speech that says, this is why I'm here.
Uh-huh.
He renounced Christianity. And he absolutely obliterated Pauline Christianity. He destroyed the credibility of the 13 letters that comprise half of the Christian New Testament that were scribed by Paul. And Paul's whole mantra is that the Torah has been done away with, it cannot save, and so that covenant been replaced with a new covenant, and the New Testament, he is the sole messenger to the world regarding this New Testament, and the New Testament of salvation is by grace as opposed to salvation through observing the Torah.
Okay, question.
Mm-hmm.
When a Christian reads, man can't live by bread alone, I'm going to give him a paraphrase. Mm-hmm. Man can't live by bread alone, but out of the every word out of the mouth of Yahweh.
Uh-huh.
Of course, they don't say Yahweh, they say God.
Mm-hmm.
And they read that, and that's supposed to be coming out of the, that's a quote coming out of the mouth of Yahusha, which mm-hmm. they call Jesus.
Mm-hmm.
And the only place you can find that word is in the Torah.
Mm-hmm.
Unless he's quoting it from the Torah.
Mm-hmm.
That's Dabarim, is the where he's quoting.
Mm-hmm.
How do you reconcile that? Now, I'm not saying the average person, because most of us were duped. But when mm-hmm. a preacher knows that, if I could find that in 5 minutes,
mm-hmm.
Then they know it.
Mm-hmm.
So now you've got to live with this lying stuff that they're doing.
Yeah, by the way, he didn't even say that man does not live by bread alone, but by every word that comes out of my mouth. Did he?
Mm-mm.
No. He said the mouth of God. Does he ever tell people to bow down to him, to pray to him?
Absolutely not. They go, no, Yahweh doesn't either.
No, and doesn't he constantly, no, Yahweh doesn't either. Doesn't he constantly direct people's attention to the Father?
Yes.
Just as he did in that quote. That happens to be a quote from the encounter that took place immediately before the Sermon on the Mount.
Right.
And so you're dealing with Matanya 3, I think, as opposed to Matanya 5. And, you know, by the time you're to Matanya 7, and you've completed the Sermon on the Mount, and you've listened to Yahweh's response to the testing by Hasatan, Christianity's gone. I mean, am I mistaken here? Or what is the first book of the Christian New Testament?
Matanya.
And after he presents his chronology for the purpose of tying Yahusha into the promises made in the Torah, Prophets, and Psalms,
mm-hmm.
and after establishing his credibility as a, don't say it, Jew,
mm-hmm. Ooh, Yehudim.
As a descendant of Dode, David.
Pretty good lineage there.
As someone who was born as promised, where the sacrificial lamb would emerge in the house of God, in the family of God, Bethlehem. You know, when once you've gone through that, and that this person is literally walking out of the pages of the Torah, Prophets, and Psalms, as promised by the Torah, Prophets, and Psalms, confirming the Torah, Prophets, and Psalms, you go from that to him citing Yahweh, not himself,
mm-hmm.
not using his own reasoning,
no,
expressly using the word of Yahweh to shortchange the offers of Satan. And then you go to the Sermon on the Mount, where he completely and totally devastates the foundational claim of Christianity.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, that's the first book of the Christian New Testament. It's over by the time you get to the seventh chapter of the first book.
I took all the key words in 5-7, I guess, and a whole bunch of tests, 8.
Mm-hmm.
And I got up early this morning and mm-hmm. went to a Greek lexicons and all and started mm-hmm. to translate. And even in those, which are overly Christian, if they can get out of it, you can't get Christian point of view from that. And you cannot twist this. Your translation here and mm-hmm. question it, Paul, it has to be the only translation there, because that's exactly what it says. It says the smallest letters are yod, and it says on and on and on and on and on. Mm-hmm. Everything is, and I say that because the audience, if you haven't done that, you're not going to find something. You're not going to find the English translation out of the lexicons.
No.
You can't get there from there.
No,
you have to twist it.
Yeah, you do. And what you have to do is do the same thing Paul does throughout his letters.
Mm-hmm.
Every time that Paul only quotes Yosher once, and I sometimes say he never quotes him because the one time he quotes him, he takes what he said out of context.
Thanks.
He changes the words. He eliminates. He goes from a statement that Yosher started with, skips what he said next, and then attaches something he said later to it, so that you create. If you were writing a fifth grade paper and you were asked to provide a citation that affirms your point, and you did this without affirming it, without quoting it accurately, without citing it in context, by misquoting it, you'd get an F on that paper. That's the one time that Paul attempts to quote Yosha, and he got it completely wrong. Well, I agree that the accurate and comprehensive evaluation of the Greek words that comprise the Sermon on the Mount is helpful. It's only helpful to a point because Yosha did not speak Greek. Matanya's account, eyewitness testimony, was not originally written in Greek. So the Greek is a translation from Hebrew into Greek by someone who was not there, probably 100 to 200 years after the fact. And Greek is a horrible language when it comes to translating Hebrew.
Right.
And so you have to be careful. But even that being the case, we should do the best we can to at least see the person, somebody, somewhere, probably in Alexandria, made an attempt to translate Hebrew into Greek. And the reason, by the way, we don't have any Hebrew copies is that rabbis, and in fact, you read this in their Talmud, they went to war against the Israelites that were Torah observant and who had embraced Yosha as such. And they not only killed them, those who had recognized Yosha as the living embodiment of the Torah, they destroyed the copies of their text written in Hebrew. In fact, there's a whole discussion in the Talmud specifically about, you know, how do you destroy them when they have Yahweh's name written in them? Because they couldn't say Yahweh's name, and yet they were superstitious, and they thought that if they burned something that had Yahweh's name in it, that there would be bad juju associated with it. So the reason we have the Dead Sea Scrolls, for example, is because they buried them in these jars because they couldn't throw them away, and they couldn't burn them, and so burying them in this way, in those jars, was the only way that they could deal with something that had Yahweh's name in it. And so they had these whole discussions, you know, what do we do with these, they're talking about Matthew's eyewitness account, and what do we do with it?
Well,
they ended up destroying it.
Let me suggest something, though. If you knew the Torah and you knew about Passover and Masa and Bikurim, and then you read where just the word like fulfill, which the Christians always hit you on the head with, has been fulfilled. Yeah. And then you go to the Greek plero, and I'll just use one word, and then show you what my thinking is and see what you think.
Mm-hmm.
Fulfill, of course, is to complete, accomplish. It's an ample supply. When you say that, I think of a payment of a ransom in full.
Mm-hmm.
But everything there, he is talking in context of the Passover, the week of Masa.
Mm-hmm.
He opens up his statement.
Passover. I think he's also talking about
Passover.
Yeah,
well,
Passover, Matzah,
Bukurim.
Yeah.
The week of Matzah, all three. And then in context,
he's going to fulfill the promises he's made relative to those days.
Mm-hmm. Of those Mikras. And he even starts it off when he opens up the scroll of Yashayah. And he only goes halfway to sentences. You know, he's saying, this is the time period I'm talking about. This is what I'm here for. This
exactly.
is what I'm going to do. He's always preached by mm-hmm. everyone that he is the Passover lamb.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if there's seven steps along the way,
mm-hmm.
how can you say he's completed everything? So the next statement, he comes down and he starts talking about don't change the jot and the tittle from the Torah. How can you throw the Torah away? He hasn't completed anything but those parts.
Oh, yeah, just,
we got three more coming.
The Christian interpretation, he has fulfilled it, therefore done away with it. It is not only wholly inconsistent with the word fulfill and what it means, it is also completely estranged from its context. If you read it in context and you have the next statement out of his mouth, not a single letter nor a single stroke of a single letter will be annulled in the Torah so long as the heavens and earth exist. Or the statement that he made prior to it, do not think that I came to do away with the Torah. Either one of those two statements in context, before or after, precludes this ridiculous conclusion that to fulfill means to do away with. He does not allow you to form that conclusion, not in being reasonable or rational.
Yeah, he's completed this promise.
Right. And by the way, it doesn't say that's the last promise he's going to complete.
Hardly.
He says there are more promises, and I will continue. In effect, Yahweh will continue to complete them, so long as the heavens and earth exist. And so, in this one opening salvo, Christianity is torn asunder. The Torah still stands. The Torah is the means to know Yahweh, to form a relationship with Him, to be saved by Him. Period.